Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rothberg. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report.
So, as I keep saying, my entire cast is made up by the crew, the people who actually make this program. But we staffed up by focusing on independent artists. So everybody that's making the show is actually a musician, a songwriter, not just a songwriter, they're fantastic musicians and songwriters. We have Jody, my dear Jody. Oh my God, this woman is so artistic, incredible. We fell in love with her music, listening to her submissions in Clubhouse. And she kindly signed up when we were asking for people to help us develop the show and has completely brought our visual branding to such an incredible level. In fact, the podcast covers that you're looking at right now, that was designed by Jody, the flyers on social media, and so much more behind the scenes. Jody, welcome to the stage. So glad to have
you. Thank you for having me. Thank you. I'm a songwriter and I write in many different genres. The song that I'm going to be talking about is called Endless Skies. It's a singer-songwriter tune that is an uplifting theme of coming home. It's a co-write with my brother Mitch, my nephew Nick, and Christine Ullman.
Such a beautiful title. What was the inspiration behind the song?
Well, when I started learning more about sync and the theme of positive coming home songs, I do have to say it's a little easier. I'm a little on the right, darker, bluesy songs is a little easier. So I really wanted to focus on writing a positive song. And that's where Endless Skies came from.
It's just mind-blowing. And now, of course, our producer, the queen of the staff, Paula Flack, the woman, I adore her voice every time she starts to speak on this platform. I want to talk a little bit about you. You know, I actually met you, God, I think it was like 15 years ago while I was working with Donovan.
I think it was more than that.
Was it? Easily. I think you're right. I think it could have been. And you were actually overseeing...
I think it might even have been 20 years ago.
Oh my God. Come on, you're dating me, Paula, at this point.
I know, sorry. It makes me feel really old when I say stuff like that.
I thought women didn't do that. What are you doing?
I know.
It was last week. We were doing this last week, Paula. I've had the pleasure of knowing you, I think the longest of anybody on the show. You've been a friend of mine since those days. You did an incredible job as marketing director for EMI, re-releasing the Donovan material. And I know you've done hundreds of other artists at that caliber and higher. And now you've moved into management. You're obviously still doing marketing for our show. You're producing television. Tell us about you and catch us up. What are you doing outside the Sync Report world?
Oh, God. Outside the Sync Report world? Well, I'm just basically trying to drag my children to every cultural opportunity that there is in London most days.
I see that on your Instagram. You're literally doing that. No, but start with the beginning. Tell us it like those EMI days.
The EMI days. It's all a bit
Give
of a haze,
juice.
To be honest. What can I tell you?
Drop some names. What titles were you involved with?
One of the first artists I worked with was Dame Shirley Bassey. And we did a photo shoot with her. And I think she turned up about 6 hours late. But we got some amazing photos. And I remember I was just an assistant in those days. And she was quite unsure about what she wanted to wear from the clothes that we had chosen for her. So we had this whole wardrobe that we'd borrowed from Harvey Nichols in London. which is a very famous, very expensive department store. And she wasn't sure what she wanted to wear, and I helped her put her outfits together. I think I was about 20 at this point. But she was, those are the highlights, really. And then just towards the end of my time at EMI, I worked with Glen Campbell. He did an album called Meet Glen Campbell and came over to the UK on tour to promote that album. And I've never worked with, apart from you, Jason, I've never worked with such an incredible team of people. They were just so nice. But obviously, it was just a few years before he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So
such a shame.
Yeah, such a huge loss.
Incredible.
And I also worked with another one, Bobby Womack. And I remember he came over because his song California Dreaming was used on a Saab TV advert.
Oh, wow.
And he came over and did a performance on Jules Holland. And I remember that The Killers were on. It was their first ever UK TV performance. And I remember Brandon Flowers running over to Bobby afterwards saying, "Oh my God, I love your music. You're such a huge influence in my life." And I think Bobby was like, "Yeah, you know," he was just really cool about it. And I also remember sitting in the changing room with him, and he was up for a couple of hours, and he was telling us all these stories from his life, basically. And unfortunately, I don't remember any of it, which is really depressing.
You sound like me.
Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?
Now, skipping forward, you're now obviously continuing doing marketing because you're our marketing director. But I know, you know, you were doing some management with some Irish talent. I think you're signing talent through the people coming through our programming.
I am.
You're managing talent now.
It's true. I was managing Stephanie Rainey, thanks to you, Jason, for a brief period.
She is
amazing.
And you were wonderful with her.
But now, yeah, again, thanks to you, I'm now looking after a couple of artists.
What an incredible show we have tonight, like every night, but they seem to keep getting better and better. But for me, I got to tell you, this is almost like Thanksgiving. One of the last Thanksgivings I had in LA, it's family tonight. I have my brother-in-law. I have his best friend. He's like my brother as well. So yeah, I'm really excited. In fact, let's bring up our guest co-host, Donovan Leach. Hello, Donovan. How are you?
Jason, could you pass the sweet potatoes, please?
Yes. Here
you go. only if I can get the drumstick.
Yeah. Okay. It's yours.
Donovan, thank you so much. The Parsons. Actually, your dad told me the Parsons. That's the tail end. So like Alan Parsons, we were talking about this.
Oh,
I know
it
is Parsons.
Yeah, that's what his last name means? I had no idea.
Wow, Alan Parsons means Alan Turkey Ass.
The Parsons Project.
Turkey Tush.
Interesting.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
What went on the road on
where
that
are we
tour?
Going?
It's good to hear from both of you, Jasons.
Yeah, it's good. I haven't seen you in a little while, Dono. It's good to hear your voice.
Yes. No, Jason and I, Nesmith and I, you know, we've known each other our entire lives, because our moms were best friends back in the 60s and still are best friends
still
today.
Are. Crazy.
50-something years later.
Noree was there at the Thanksgiving with us.
Yep. Yep. That's right. So we've known each other our entire life. We were in a band together in the 90s for 10 years called Nancy Boy. And yeah, we've just always, it's been the kind of relationship with you, Jason, where even if we don't speak for a while, we just kind of pick up exactly where we left off, which is always
100%. Yeah. And I actually feel like you and I, Oni, are literally my brother and sister. I mean, we feel like family, because it's just, that's how families do it. They grow up together, and that's what we did. So, you know, it's amazing. Yep.
This is what I'm saying. This is the family hour tonight. I'm so excited. Actually, Donna, the last time I was in New York, it was crazy. We fly into JFK, hobble into a taxi, and now the taxis, Rose, you know, these taxis have screens in the back seats.
Yes.
And there's Donovan's production. You did this musical with the Go-Go's.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always been really interested in musical theater. You know, I was an actor in high school going to Hollywood High, and I was in the theater program and doing theater, doing shows like Man of La Mancha and Guys and Dolls and stuff like that. And being kind of a child of the 80s and meeting the Go-Go's back in the early days. And actually, our band Nancy Boy, we opened for the Go-Go's a couple of times. So,
oh, wow.
I was really interested in putting together a musical, I had reached out to the Go-Go's. And even though I had never produced a musical before, they had given me an option. They said, you've got 6 months to find a writer. And my producing partner on it was my old friend Gwyneth Paltrow. So she was definitely helpful with setting up some calls and getting some money just to get the ball rolling. And
couldn't get anyone better for that.
Yeah. So we ended up hiring a writer named Jeff Witte, who had written Avenue Q, and he had won a Tony for best book. So we suddenly had ourselves a Tony winning writer, and he wrote we thought it was going to be a kind of a bio musical on the history of the Go-Go's, kind of like Jersey Boys is a history of the Four Seasons. Well, he came to us with a story that was written in the 1600s by Sir Philip Sidney about the land of Arcadia and kings and queens and oracles and princesses and prophecies, and set to the music of the Go-Go's. So it's a book set in the 1600s and the music is the 1980s. And it was so crazy, such an insane idea, that it actually worked. And we got the show all the way to Broadway. And it ran for 6 months. And it's coming to Los Angeles. It's opening Incredible. At the Pasadena Playhouse. And it's the first time that there's going to be a musical at Pasadena Playhouse in over 2 years. They're doing a really interesting version of the show where it's going to be immersive. They've taken out all the seats in the theater, so the audience mills around with the cast. And it's sort of like a dance party. They've taken the intermission out. So it's a 90-minute, no intermission dance party with the show and performers and music. And then in less than a week, the Go-Go's get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow.
That's amazing.
Incredible.
What a great story.
I got to brag, you know, not just because he's family, but I got to say, I mean, Donovan's done it all. Fashion, billboards, magazines. He's done music to the coolest degree. We're actually going to talk about Nancy Boy in a little bit. But he's also an incredible film producer, and I'm so proud of him. He's just completed another film. I think the distribution's already set, and you're rolling along. Tell us about this new film. I think your wife is even one of the lead actresses. I mean, so cool.
Yeah, my wife, Libby Mintz, is a wonderful actress and a writer. And her and her best friend, Janelle Shurtcliffe, wrote a screenplay together called Habit. It's a very early 90s Tarantino-style movie. It's sort of bad girls dress up as nuns to avoid capture from an evil drug dealer. And it's a lot of fun. And we shot the movie, literally rewrapped a day before Los Angeles shut down. So we really lucked out as far as that went. Wow. Bella Thorne is our lead actress in it. And we cast some cool musicians. Gavin Rossdale's in the movie. The Kills are in the film. And Paris Jackson, Michael Jackson's daughter's in the movie. She actually plays Jesus Christ.
Oh, God.
Paris Jackson, Michael Jackson's daughter is Jesus Christ. That really got the Catholic community upset.
It came out
this August. It is now currently available for streaming. So anyone out there that wants to see Habit, just go to iTunes or Amazon.
What's it called?
Habit. Like, it's a double entendre.
Habit.
Habit. Nun Habit. Yeah. Drug Habit. H-A-B-I-T. Habit.
Hamburger Habit.
Hamburger Beautiful. Habit.
Like a nun's habit or a drug habit.
I know what I'm watching tonight.
Yes, yes. Definitely Habit is available, and it's a lot of fun. And we did a great job. And it's never easy making a film and an independent film for not a lot of money, not a lot of shoot days, but we got it done. And then I was lucky enough to immediately follow up with another production called We Need to Do Something, which is also on any kind of streaming, Amazon, iTunes, Google. Really, really wonderful actress, Sierra McCormick, Pat Healy, Vanessa Shaw. And that was a movie where 95% of the film takes place in a bathroom. And it's about a tree that falls on a house and traps a family during a tornado. And so the whole family, who are pretty screwed up, are trapped in a bathroom. But you find out it's something a little darker and more mysterious than just a tornado. And there's that monster on the other side of the door that you never actually see.
Oh.
And I got I got Ozzy Osbourne to do the voice of the monster.
Did you really?
Oh my God.
That's awesome.
So cool.
And the funny thing is we didn't give him any credit up front in the film. So, because he only says one line in the movie. So when you're watching the movie on the end credit crawl, it says Devil Dog, Ozzy Osbourne.
Ozzy Osbourne.
So fast.
Yeah.
So
cool. Incredible.
He's the unsung hero of the movie, or nemesis.
You are the unsung hero of the show. In fact, Donovan, if you don't come back and, as a featured guest, I'll be really upset. I'll have to leave the family.
Okay. I'll send you my fee, and we'll work something out.
All right, I'll pass that straight on to Rose. So
yeah. I'll have my people talk to your people, okay?
Yeah.
And anytime you need me, I'm here.
I love you, Donovan. Thank you. Thank you for being here tonight. I can't wait to hear the conversation between you and Jason. Thank you for joining us. Again, I'm so pleased you're here. And I know that Jason's one of your dearest friends. So I'm going to let you guys just kind of chat away for part of this interview.
Great. Hey, Dono, how's it going?
Hello, Jason. How are you? I'm fine. I'm just fine.
Very good. Glad to be here.
How's the family?
Family's good. My son just went a whole season undefeated in football, flag football, because we don't want him to play tackle. So that's great. We're going to go fishing tomorrow. All sorts of good things with the fam. How about you?
It's so funny that you become such an avid fisherman.
I know, that's crazy. I still can't get Rob Montalbano to fish with me. But maybe someday soon. He keeps threatening to fish with me.
Everybody listening, just say Montalbano.
Montalbano. Yeah.
Montalbano.
We've been doing it for 50 years. So ask me something. What do you want to know that you don't already know?
Well, it's funny. You said you had a dream the other night about Nancy Boy performing again.
You know, it was really bizarre. I dream a lot, for one. But also, my dreams are so realistic that when I wake up the next morning, I often feel that I've actually had that conversation or actually hung out with that person. And my dream the other night, it was just the night before last, I dreamt that you were in my dream and we were hanging out and we were sitting on a couch somewhere, and it felt like kind of one of our old, like an old dingy club or a house party or something. And we were talking, and we were talking about Nancy Boy, and it was almost like I felt like I was trying to convince you to get the band back together. And then you were responsive. You liked the idea. And then I said, you know, if we just start rehearsing. But then it was weird, because then I said, we need to find some guys, which implied Mike and Nigel were not available, which is weird. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why I thought that. But I was like, we got to get some guys, and we just got to get in the rehearsal room and start playing. And then, you know, the gigs will come. We'll figure out what to do. We'll figure out what the next foot forward is. And then I just remember this part. Then I actually had a guitar in my hand suddenly, and I was playing a riff, and you started singing over it. That's right. I forgot about that part of the dream. So we actually wrote a little song in my dream too, which is very weird.
You don't remember the song, do you?
No, of course I can't remember. Sadly. But yeah.
The last time we played together was just about 6 years ago, when we had a Nancy Boy reunion at my wedding.
That's right. I just watched footage of that for some reason. I think my wife posted something, footage from that somewhere. And we were doing Welcome to My World.
I think Milfredo has a Nancy Boy track. Should we play something for the audience so they know what you're talking about?
Sure,
absolutely.
Why not?
And is it the song that we chose? Is it Johnny Chrome and Silver?
We're gonna be surprised.
We'll find out.
Okay. Spin the wheel, Jason. Spin the wheel.
Milfredo, let's hear that Nancy Boy track. must bring back such wonderful memories for the two of you.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you guys are both from LA, I think it wasn't until you guys were together in London. Is that when you decided to do Nancy Boy?
Nancy Boy started actually in LA. Donovan.
It did.
And I should probably let you tell the story because he had the idea of this character, Nancy Boy, and he sort of came to me with the idea. And the band started, you know, from that idea. But yeah, go on, Donovan.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I was very, very influenced by David Bowie, and I loved any bands where the singers kind of had a persona, you know, and the fact that Bowie had so many different personas. We had written this song because it was early 90s and the look was kind of androgyny, you know, it was sort of pre-grunge. So I created this character named Nancy Boy, who was this androgynous rock star. And the very, very first song we wrote together was called Gender Bender. And Jason and I recorded. I went over to Jason's place and we recorded the song Gender Bender. And then a second song called New Attitude.
Oh my God, I forgot about that one, yeah.
And I had also at the time just was moving to New York City from Los Angeles. And I was working as a male model in the New York fashion scene and hanging out with all those incredible designers, photographers, models. That kind of became the reference point for Nancy Boy, period. And so we all decided, let's all move to New York. Let's immerse ourselves in this world, this sort of downtown fashion world, and dress up and wear makeup and glitter and play downtown New York clubs. And we really kind of created a really cool vibe. And we were playing every Thursday night at a club called Don Hills. We started building a following. And then pretty soon afterwards, the legendary music executive Seymour Stein signed us to Sire Records.
Yes.
And before we knew it,
oh, right,
we were in the studio making our record.
Yeah, I remember seeing Dono at the Rock Hall of Fame when his father was inducted and hanging out with Seymour. And I was like, wow, boy, this guy knows. I had no idea he signed you. That's amazing.
I remember, Donovan, I hope I have this right, but I remember you saying to me, I just did a photo shoot with a photographer named Steven Meisel.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that one of the first guys that shot you and kind of got you going in that world? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I kind of just got thrown into this world, and it was like working with photographers like Steven Meisel and Peter Lindbergh and Ellen Von Unwerth, and they loved it. I mean, they loved the idea of this kind of, you know, this androgynous male look, and that was really before Marilyn Manson did Mechanical Animals and that band Orgy. And you know, it just was kind of a vibe.
Yeah, it was all starting to happen in the early 90s, that look. And, you know, that your involvement and your successful modeling career definitely shaped the way, you know, shaped Nancy Boy's sort of trajectory. And really, I mean, we ended up doing so many kind of cool, interesting, different things as a band because of that. Not the least of which was, you know, me and the two other guys in the band, Nigel and Mike, we would walk the runway with Donovan and then pick up instruments at the end and play a song.
Yeah.
I had never seen a band do that before. Yeah.
We totally infiltrated the fashion world. And also we were, I don't know if you remember, Jason, we were signed to Ford Models as a band.
The first band they ever signed. I think maybe the only band they ever
signed. Wait, the band got signed to a modeling agency.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
As a band got signed, we had one of those like modeling cards.
Yeah.
And we would go out and we would actually shoot campaigns for Guess jeans and things like that. And then,
oh my God,
Tommy Hilfiger one season designed an entire collection.
Like a line, yeah.
Based on Nancy Boy.
We did more editorial press at first, doing like what he just said, you know, fashion spreads in magazines, than we even had as, you know, as a band, you know, just getting regular press for our music. So, I mean, it was really like by the time people knew about or got to hear our music, they had actually already seen us around. It was really an amazing way to kind of...
Like somebody put together the most brilliant marketing plan ever.
I mean, it was an amazing way to market the band. It really was. I mean, I don't even think we knew it at the time. It was kind of like one of those things you look back on and you think, you couldn't buy exposure like that. I mean, it was really something where that all came together. And it just kind of happened organically because Donovan was on this, you know, upward trajectory in that career, and we were on this upward trajectory in our band's career, and it all kind of lined up, and it was cool, and it led to a lot of good times, that's for sure.
It led to a lot of good times, but in retrospect, what the reason I think Nancy Boy didn't like kind of go to that next level and become a breakout band, because we had a great album. Shel Talmy was our producer, the guy who discovered The Who and The Kinks, but by the time we recorded a lot of our record in London, and when we got to London, that was the emergence of the whole Britpop scene.
Yeah.
And I remember like Melody Maker and Enemy and the music press were so snarky, and they just viewed us as nothing more than like a fashion plate band with no talent. You know, that was that was kind of what we were up against.
Yeah, we were up against that for sure.
And then also Jason and I both being sons of, you know, that we had that criticism against us. And it was kind of hard sometimes for the music to just kind of be listened to without those kind of like stereotypes hanging over us.
Preconceptions, like, oh,
these,
and
they're just sons of rock stars and they're just fashion whores and like whatever.
The NME and Melody Maker for years have been known to kind of take sides. Like one will pick one band they like and the other will pick the other band they like. Well, they both hated us. So we were, first band to get be hated by both magazines, which is a first. I mean, come on. Yeah. That's cool.
I know. And then I remember when that band Placebo came out. You remember Placebo?
Oh, yeah.
And they had a song called Nancy Boy. And I remember reading NME one day and they were talking about us and Placebo. And Enemy always used to like pit bands against each other, right? Because that sells papers. And they said something to the effect of, Placebo has done more with one song than Nancy Boy has done with their entire career.
I remember when that song came out, we were in Australia and we're like, okay, we gotta write Placebo Effect. So
that's right.
So we wrote that song. Whatever. That song disappeared. I don't think it ever got released.
I know Placebo Effect was a good song. We would write songs as like almost like, you know, like hip hop artists today, like, you know, write like call and answer songs to each other where they, you know, we were kind of doing that. Like people would write something when Paper Magazine called us Bitch Boys.
Oh, is that? I didn't know. That's where Bitch Boy came from?
Yeah. We wrote a song called Bitch Boy. And we were Bitch Boys because we were the ones that catered to the models. Like, we were the ones who just, you know, ran their errands and, you know. And it was like, what is a bitch boy?
I love the fact that you guys are doing like call and response, hip hop, 80s style songs. Yeah. We're going to get into a song battle.
Yeah, exactly. Way before everyone else was doing it.
Well, and what's funny now is that, like, so a lot of the criticism we got for doing that kind of stuff, of course, now everybody does that. You know, bands are involved in all elements of fashion and music and film and commercials, and, you know, but back then it still wasn't quite, you know, it wasn't as acceptable. So I'd like to think of us as trailblazers.
Oh, we certainly, I think we were way ahead of the curve. Like, I really believe that if Nancy Boy had come out a couple of years later, it might have been a totally different story.
Yeah, I think so too. Interesting.
But anyways, there are people who come up to me, and there are people who reach out to me on social media, and they say Nancy Boy was their all-time favorite band. And it was an era. No,
it was
unbelievable moment. And who knows, like, we were kind of joking around with the idea of doing like a kind of a fake documentary, like a Nancy Man, like these middle-aged guys that have to squeeze into their old glam
outfits. My god, you must. Oh, you have to. That is brilliant. That's freaking brilliant.
Nancy Man, you like
Nancy
that
man. Yeah. It's amazing. It really
we'll
is
all look like Gary Glitter.
But we won't act like
god
Gary
forbid
Glitter.
Yeah, but
we won't act like he
didn't age well, guys. You guys are both gorgeous still. So
you're too kind.
Donovan, I know you wanted to ask Jason about what he's working on now. So, yeah,
let's, hey, Jason.
Should we find out what that man's up to?
What's going on, buddy? Well, I'm so glad you asked. Funny you should ask. Just released a new series on HBO Max, came out September 13th, called Little Ellen. And me and my partner, Jason Blackman, wrote about 25 original songs for the show. And that's out. I recently wrote the theme for a new show on Access TV called Rock My Collection, hosted by Amit Zappa. And Rock My Collection is actually a very interesting show. It's kind of the antique roadshow of rock memorabilia. So all
oh
these
my God, people, that's great.
It is really interesting. And it's actually become quite a hit on that network. People just bring all sorts of cool things to the show. You know, this guitar signed by this guy, this jacket worn by this guy. And it's really fun to watch. And then a guy kind of gives it an appraisal for what its value is. And I'm also working on a new animated series for Adult Swim called Warp Drive, which is about a rock and roll band that travels the universe and gets into all sorts of different troubles and, you know, saving princesses and, you know, a la Star Wars kind of thing. So that's sort of scheduled for early next year.
A lot of animation.
You know, it's been a lot of animation. I've sort of fallen into that space recently. You know, I have that show that I did the theme for called Jesse and Nessie, which is on Amazon right now. And yeah.
Well, I guess with animation, obviously during the pandemic, that's like from the people that I know in that world, they were like, we've never been busier because you don't need live people.
When we started Little Ellen in 2019, the end of 2019, right sort of, you know, before we went in the studio with some of the voice actors for them to sing some of our stuff in January, you know, and February. And then, of course, everything hit in 2020 of March and shut everything down. But yeah, we were able to completely continue because everybody could work very successfully remotely on something like an animated series. It was interesting. What Warner Brothers did is they sent the voice actors these microphone and software packages.
Right, packages, yeah.
So that they could work out of their house. And so they literally have these voice actors with their moms and dads on the computers running it through the studios at Warner Brothers. And then the voice director and myself would produce and, you know, sort of get them going. And they did it all remotely.
Did they like accelerate the project? Like, oh my God, there's nothing being shot right now. We better get this Little Ellen thing going.
Well, you know, I don't know because it seemed to take forever. We were working on that. We started in 2019.
Animation takes forever, doesn't it?
And it took for, yeah. So it came out in September of this year. So it's, if they did fast track it, then I would hate to see what it's like if they don't do that.
Did the Ellen drama affect any of it, like from the Ellen show?
Well, that's a really good question. And, you know, me and a couple of the show creators and a couple of the other creatives on the show have been discussing the fact that we hope it gets a second season. The show itself, really, Ellen is the lead character, but from there, it's not like it's an animated biopic of her childhood. It really has very little to do with what she actually did as a child. It's just this group of kids getting into adventures, and it takes place in New Orleans where she grew up. And it's very, very sweet, and it's a very, you know, kind of forward-thinking, kind, conscious type of show, which has always been her sort of thing anyway. But I don't know. The answer is we don't know yet. And possibly the drama around everything that went on might affect it. It might sort of make people see it in a slightly different light, but we don't know yet. I mean, obviously the demographic is kids, so.
I mean, I sort of felt she got a little bit maligned. And I think that the decision, it wasn't like all of a sudden the next day, you know, the show's off the air. It's like she has had that show on for ages and they're sort of winding it down in sort of the right tempo. I think she maybe didn't lose that much of her audience, you know?
I'm hoping you're right. And I actually completely agree with you. And we were all kind of waiting to see, because, you know, I've been writing for that show since season one. So, I mean, I've been on that show for 19 years, which is insane. And writing, you know, multiple segments for it every year and multiple things. And I have a ton of music in that franchise. And, you know, when that all sort of surfaced, I personally...
Is that why you have such a nice swimming pool?
I think it might be. I personally have never met Ellen. And, you know,
you're kidding me. You worked for her for 19 years. You've never met her?
Never met her, but I've only been on the set one time. And it's because one of the show's executive producers, a guy named David McGuire, who's actually, I think, senior VP at Telepictures, is one of my old childhood friends. And so he and I have gotten together for lunch over the years and spoke. And he invited me down to the set once. And I came down and spent time with him. But I've never had to be on the set. That's one of the sort of weird things about working in the industry that I've been working in now for so long, is that FaceTime, being in person, is really not that necessary for much. You know, like they send me music briefs. We're doing a segment about, you know, Ellen goes to a balloon factory and we need some funny clown music. And so can you do this? And I do it. And
right. Yeah.
I never half the time I don't see the finished product.
I had an interview with Ellen for the Ellen Show.
Really?
Because, not to be a guest on the show, one of the original DJs, I guess, that guy Johnny, what's his face?
Right. Before Twitch, who's the guy now, right?
Before Twitch, or yeah, that DJ.
Right.
The original DJ was leaving the show, and I had been recommended to come in and replace that DJ.
Really?
So
that's cool.
I went in and I sat down, I had a meeting with Ellen and Portia and her producers. I didn't get the job.
Ah, very good, very good.
But I wish I had.
I don't think I have. I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, I may have been introduced to her briefly years ago, but I don't think so. But the same, you know, I've been working with Harvey Levin on that TMZ franchise since 2008, and I've only met him once. I met him one time in passing in the hallway. I was there with the music supervisor. We were going over some segments and what they needed musically. And I actually spent a little more time down on that set with the music supervisor, a guy named Tony Wilgus, who's amazing, wonderful guy. And, you know, he's had me do so much music for that show over the years, and actually was instrumental in helping me write the theme for TMZ Live, which was one of the shows that came out of the original franchise. But yeah, I mean, you just don't really need to be around as a musician. Nobody really needs to see you. They just want your music, and they don't care about anything else.
Yeah, you're just living in a little cave somewhere.
It is weird, man. I tell you, the composer life, and I remember another older composer telling me this years ago when I first kind of got in this thing. He's like, "You're going to spend a lot of time alone. Hope you're okay with that." And I'm like, "Well, I think I am. I mean, you know, as long as I'm sort of creatively busy, I think that should be okay." But he wasn't kidding. I haven't been out of this room in 20 years. No, I'm kidding. But
oh my God.
It's it is.
The only time I see you is in that room.
It's in that room. It's very weird. And yeah, like I said, especially coming from our band, because, you know, Nancy Boy was the last live thing I really did. That's not 100% true. I was in a band with Mark Ford for a couple of years after Nancy Boy, and we played a bunch of live stuff. But that's sort of, you know, coming from that world into the composer world was definitely a switch socially and you know, amongst other things. So it's crazy. But here I am alone in my room. I'm not even with you now. See, I'm still by myself.
No.
We're talking.
This is just so much fun. I knew having the two of you on at the same time would just really cause this chemistry. But of course, our time is running out.
Yes.
Yeah. So honestly, Jason, we're going to have you back, because I had to murder Lisa's beautiful script. There's so many points that we've been jumping over tonight. You have such an incredible journey. And I know you're just kind of at the beginning. It's going to keep on happening, and bigger and better and more orchestral, should I say?
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm so looking forward to what you're going to do next. And Donovan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I want you both back on the show, if you would. I hope you guys had a good time.
We did.
Oh, we had a great time. This has been fun.
And Donovan, let's get the family together.
Absolutely. You
know, we only live 2 miles from each other.
We live like literally 3 miles from one another. Get our lovely wives.
I would love it. All right. Well, we'll see you soon.
I want an invitation. I want to be there.
Yes, you're welcome.
Okay.
Your lovely wife actually was there the last time I was at Donovan's house.
I know. She told me actually had the best time hanging out with you.
Yeah, we had a great time. Great.
Yeah, she sends her love, of course. I know you talked to your sister yesterday, Dono. So that's
I talked to Estrella yesterday. And I'm She's very excited because I have traveled in such a long time. So we're checking off a bucket list activity, and we're flying my wife and my son, Donovan the Third, D3. We are flying to Helsinki, Finland.
Whoa, that's cool.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And then from there, we're going to this other area in Lapland, and we're going to stay in one of those igloos and look at the northern
lights. I was just looking at that online. That's crazy, Donna. Oh my God. Yeah, that's awesome. I was just looking at that. You have to tell me how it is.
Well, your sister's talked about it forever. She's dying to do that trip. Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
You'll come to Ireland maybe on your way home.
That could work. We're going for Thanksgiving week, so
that's cool.
We'll have roast reindeer. Kidding.
Oh, none of my deer.
Roast faux reindeer. Everything's faux.
Roast faux reindeer. Yes.
Yes.
We're gonna paint it.
We're all very sensitive.
We're glad you're here. So grab a drink. Let's have a conversation about music and sync.
Oh. Oh my God, Rose, we are going to have so much fun tonight. In fact, I can't wait any longer. Enough with the banter. Paula, come back, open up your mic, let everybody know who we have on stage tonight.
We have Jason Naismith on the show this week, Jason. For the last two decades, Los Angeles-based Jason Naismith has proven to be one of the most successful composers in TV and film. He has been one of the primary composers for the Ellen DeGeneres Show for over 18 years, has worked on Ellen's Design Challenge, and continues to work on Little Ellen. He is known for writing successful theme songs for shows including Anderson Live, TMZ Live, Extra, Tyra Banks, CNN New Day, Let's Ask America, Judge Jean Pirro, Modern Waheen Hawaii, Labrakazam, The Crumbling of America, Play with Portion, and a show for Access TV called Breaking Band. Since its launch in 2013, he has composed music for Microsoft Surface Tablet TV adverts. Jason has also undertaken extensive scoring for documentaries on the History Channel, Discovery Channel, and National Geographic Network. In his rock and roll days, Jason formed the 90s hip-hop group Nancy Boy with our guest co-host Donovan Leach, going on to be signed by music legend Seymour Stein to the iconic Sire Records. As an in-demand touring and recording guitarist, he became the live music director for Geffen Records under Ron Fair and was a key player on the Hollywood live music scene. He has performed, written, and recorded with Ben Harper and Ahmet Zappa, among others. Today, he continues to write and produce for some of the longest-running successful TV shows and has several new projects that we will talk about during the show. Jason Naismith's music can literally be heard 24/7 worldwide. Let's give Jason a warm welcome.
Thank you, Paula. Oh my God, we have such an incredible guest tonight. Jason Naismith, welcome to the Sync Report. How are you today?
Hi, everyone. I'm good. How are you guys?
Excited, sitting on pins and needles. Can't wait to go through this journey with you. And I was talking offline to Rose. I mean, just incredible everything that you've done. Again, you know, from the early days in bands, moving into television and film. But what I'd like to do, what we like to do here on the Sync Report, is kind of start way, way back. So you're born in Los Angeles. Your mother and father are both obvious music lovers. So I'm just wondering, what kind of music was in the house when you're growing up?
Well, yes. So I was born in 1968 in West Hollywood, and my mom was a photographer and my dad was a musician, and they were both working in the industry at the time. And there was a lot of music around the house. And sort of apropos of, you know, maybe early middle 70s when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, you know, a lot of Beatles, Stones, Pink Floyd, Eagles, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, that kind of stuff being played. I mean, I immediately connected to it.
It was something really about the Beatles. Was Rubber Soul when we were talking?
So Rubber Soul was the first Beatles record I'd heard. And I don't remember why, because I know it wasn't their first record, but it was, I think maybe I gravitated towards the cover. You know, this was back when we had vinyl and there were these big, beautiful album covers.
Yeah.
Side note, my mom was actually an album cover designer. which I forgot. But so she had this board where she would design album covers, like old school with paper and pencils and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I remember really liking that album cover and listening to that record. And that really was, I think, the first Beatles record that caught my attention. And I, you know, I just couldn't believe that there was music like this. It just, and everything was so good. It, you know, it just really connected me immediately. And I went through, my mom had all the records. She had Meet the Beatles. She had the first Canadian pressing of Meet the Beatles. So then I then went back to that. And it's that story where I just played the records until the vinyls, you know, grooves practically ran out. But, you know, I picked up a guitar. There was a guitar there that she had gotten in New Jersey, a Guild guitar she had gotten that was actually a really good guitar. And it was a small style acoustic guitar. So it was good for me because I was little. And I just started kind of playing along to these Beatles songs, and I liked it. And I was able to kind of play along. I mean, not really, but I was able to kind of blend in a little bit. It starts off with acoustic guitar, and it's a very sort of, and now that I'm thinking about it, I think a lot of the album is acoustic in nature, a lot of that record. But I remember the lyrics, too, of that song really made me, you know, I remember just being in that room with that woman, and yeah, of course I was a kid. So, but you know, but just that whole sort of romantic thing about that song was also very much part of my experience with that particular song.
Well, for me, just hearing you say that, it's like, no wonder why you ended up scoring to Scene, because you're visualizing music already at that age.
Yeah, very much.
In your mind's eye, which is how cool. But there it wasn't just like the great classic rocks. You were also listening to Beethoven and Mozart at this age. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was a big thing in my house. My mother was very much into the, you know, the kind of the ballets and some of the classics, particularly Swan Lake, Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. And so she played that all the time. And another one, which is, has a very interesting sort of cycle in my life, was Brahms, the Hungarian Dances by Brahms. So she was playing those all the time. I mean, equally as much as any of the other music I mentioned. And I connected with that music very, very early on and very passionately then, as well as the Beatles and Stones and blah, blah, blah. And years later, I ended up writing these quartets, and I've had people tell me that they sound very Hungarian. And I don't know if that is somehow me tapping into my childhood connection to Brahms's Hungarian Dances or not, but I don't know what I did specifically that makes them sound that way. So I can't say that it was deliberate. So it makes me feel like it's a little more, you know, spiritual in a way that that kind of happened.
I'll go with that.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. So the diversity of music in my household was constant, and music was playing constant.
Do you think those influences kind of what made you put the guitar down and pick up the clarinet? Or was it simply because that was the last instrument on the rack? Or what happened there?
Well, I did play clarinet. And it is true that I played clarinet only because I couldn't play saxophone. They didn't have any saxophones left. I thought the saxophone was a much cooler instrument. But I was I was happy to be included in the band at all. So I took the clarinet, and that was good. And I played that for a couple of years.
But do you think, like, the fact that you were kind of forced into that instrument, did that affect, because now that you're doing concertos and thinking more in these operatic, bigger orchestral sounds, do you think that plays a role in what you're doing there, and you're thankful that it wasn't the sax?
You know, I do, actually, because it, in learning the clarinet, it exposed me to sheet music, and then, you know, and basic music theory at that point, and I loved it. You know, there are two sides, or there's a few different sides on how people think about music theory and whether, you know, whether you need it or don't need it, or whether it should be or shouldn't be. And I don't pay much attention to any of those arguments. I just kind of think of what's right for myself. And for me, it's, I've been very, very interested in music theory. And I think it's one of the reasons that classical music attracts me so much then and now, is because of its complexity and how much is going on. And to me, the thought and the creativity and the thinking behind that music is just overwhelming to me. And I love the idea of pursuing that and writing in that way. And also because what the music I hear in my head has so many things going on. It's not one melody. It's the secondary melody. It's the tertiary melody. It's the harmony. It's the counterpoints going on. I hear all that in my head. So most music, I'm not able to do that in. You know, I write in a lot of genres, and most genres don't require that type of a thing going on. So, you know, it's one of the reasons it's become such a vigorous pursuit of mine as of late, the last decade or so.
So at this time, you're absorbing so much culture and arts because it's not just music, but you were getting involved with drama. And if I'm not mistaken, I think you did Tom Sawyer, mm-hmm. West Side Story, King Lear.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy putting down the instrument and getting on stage?
At that age, I was very much into performing. I loved being on stage, and I did all the plays you mentioned. I actually did another play called Bye Bye Birdie, I'm remembering now, and I played Conrad Birdie, and I was singing on stage. And, you know, if you know me now, you kind of know how sort of far away from that I went. But at that age, yeah, I mean, now the idea of it is not appealing to me. But at that age, yeah, I loved drama, and I loved theater, and I loved musical theater. You know, it's funny. I was watching my son play football yesterday, and behind me at this school, he was playing another school, behind me was the drama class. And I looked at the football field, and then I looked at the drama class, and I thought, you know, that's where I would have been. I would have been in the drama class. You know, and so, yeah, I was very much into that at that age. But that changed quite a bit when I became a little older, 16, 17. Things changed.
All right. So at the top of the show, I mentioned my last Thanksgiving in L.A. You and your mom were there. We were at Dono's mom's house. It was gorgeous. But the first time I ever met you was at a concert, was at one of your concerts. I saw you 1992-ish playing in a band called The Beauties.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, can you give us a little bit of background on The Beauties, how it came together, and, you know, what was your memories of that period?
Well, so The Beauties started, I think, in 90, 91, and I was coming out of a band called Kill for Thrills, which was a rock band, and we were on MCA. Gilby Clark started that band. He went on to Guns N' Roses fame and
his own
solo career. He did quite well, does quite well. And The Beauties started very organically. I met a guy named Stephen McNeil, and we just kind of started, you know, we were sitting around his apartment playing guitars, and he would sing and write lyrics, and it all kind of grew out of that. And I had made a lot of relationships from my last band, so we were able to kind of get management, we were able to get a record deal, and the band lasted about 2 or 3 years. That's right, we were the first signing of Gasoline Alley, who then went on to, I think the second signing was Sublime. So
Isn't that Randy Phillips, right?
That was Randy Phillips
who read. Yeah, yeah.
And they were great, and they also actually happened to be our managers at the time too. So, you know, we had a lot of opportunity, and it really was a very open and experimental type of situation for all of us. And I really got to, you know, try writing in different kind of ways. It was much less rock and roll than the previous band I had been in, and more kind of a little more jammy, a little more acoustic-y, a little more, you know, kind of hippie-y. And it was a lot of fun. You know, timing-wise, though, we were coming out with this kind of groovy, we all love each other acoustic stuff right around when Nirvana was hitting. So it was not quite right. The timing was just a little weird. I don't know.
I was into all of that. Of course, yeah. I loved the whole grunge scene, but your live performance, that was, I think, in fact, I'm going to pause this right now and forget the audience. This is for me. Milfredo, let's play Mother's Finest Son, please. Honestly, I love the band. I love everything that you do, Jason. I know my time is running out. I'm going to actually pass the mic to my co-host, Rose, who has loads of questions regarding all the film and TV work that you've moved into. Cool. And then, of course, we have Donovan closing out the show with talking about Nancy Boy and some of your guys' childhood memories and everything that's on the horizon for you. So yeah, Rose, take it away.
Thanks, Jason. Nice speaking with you.
Hi, Jason. This is Rose. Hi. In New York. You're in LA. You know, I was really like taken back when I started reading your bio and seeing how many theme songs you've done. And just recently, I've been saying how I miss theme songs. You know, it's like when I was growing up and watching television, theme songs were my favorite part of a lot of shows. How did you get into that and do so much work in so many different places?
Well, you know, it started kind of, I wasn't even kind of looking in that space musically. And I started working with a composer years ago, early 2000s. And he was very much into television, music for television. And we were working together and a new show came across his desk. It was a new talk show for a guy named Larry Elder, who was a big radio host out here. And he just recently ran for governor in California. But
yes,
they had he was doing a show. And so the composer that I was working with said, would you like to try writing some music for the theme, for the open? There's going to be a bunch of guys doing it, but if you want to put in some music, you know, go for it. So I thought, well, okay. So I got a rundown of what they were looking for. Anyway, I wrote a piece of music. There was probably, you know, 100 pieces of music submitted, and they chose my music. And we were all shocked, especially some of my other composer friends who'd been in that world for a while. They were like, that's really kind of lucky and unheard of. Anyway, so they ran with that music all summer. Now, sadly, at the very last minute, they pulled the music and ended up using something else. So it was wonderful, and then a hard lesson to follow about how quickly those things can change. But that got me kind of in the door. And then about a year later, I wrote a theme for a judge show, because judge shows are very popular.
Big, daytime programming.
Exactly. There's tons of them. And this was a show called Judge Jeanine Pirro,
who's on Fox. Yeah,
that's right. So she now has a different show on Fox, but that's right. And I think this was actually on Fox. But anyway, I wrote the theme song for that. And so that kind of started me down this road that I really had, you know, I wasn't really aware of, hadn't ever really thought about. And in making my relationships on that show, it just led to kind of one talk show, one news program after another. And I started working with these franchises like TMZ that became these huge franchises. I was writing for Harvey Levin when he had a little website.
Wow.
And then he said, we're putting this show called TMZ on TV. And he hired me and a couple other composers to help kind of sonically shape the show. And then I ended up writing the theme for TMZ Live. And that led to Extra. And that led to the Anderson Show and the Tyra Banks Show. And this kind of weird...
It goes on and on.
At the same time, I started writing for the Ellen DeGeneres talk show, too.
Yeah, which is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't write her theme, but I was writing segments for her for years.
And she's so musically oriented. I mean, she loves music. So,
well, you know what's funny is that a lot of times people say, oh, there's music in that show, which I can't lie, hurts a little bit. But but you're right, she is. And there's a ton of music in that show, believe it or not. And she is very musical. Yeah.
And now she's doing an animated show for HBO.
That's right. So one of the relationships at that show, I've literally been writing for her since season one. So that's 19 years.
Wow.
And about 6 years ago, I got connected with one of the writers over there, the comedy writers, the sketch, you know, comedy writer.
Yeah.
But he's also a really talented musician. And he started writing these kind of musical comedy sketches.
Yeah.
And we connected and wrote a bunch of stuff for her show. And then he actually developed this show called Little Ellen. His name's Jason Blackman.
Right.
And he said, you know, we're going to sell the show, and do you want to do music and blah, blah, blah. And so he did sell the show and brought me on board end of 2019. We've done 40 episodes for Warner Brother Animation now. And
That's
been
amazing.
A wonderful show. Yeah. And it's a really good show. The art in it is particularly beautiful. It's two-dimensional art. They didn't go sort of that standard 3D art that we're also used to with cartoons. And it looks just wonderful. And so we did a bunch of original songs for that, yeah.
And you did the pandemic stories on Netflix, which was funny because my son did one of them.
Oh, he did?
He's a director. And he, Chris Abbott, and Brady Corbet were all locked up for a pandemic in East Hampton while he was writing a a big series for HBO, and they did one, and Netflix asked them to do one because he had done Devil All the Time last year for them. And then they said, would you do one of these pandemic stories? So I thought that was funny that you did that.
I did one episode. Brad Johnson was the name of the producer and the director. And he is he's actually also in the show and wonderfully talented interviewer. I actually thought he was in journalism as maybe a newscaster or broadcaster or something, but turns out this was his first venture into television, and he did a wonderful job. But it was a fun project to be involved in. And you know, and the angle on that is it was all about what positive things came out of the pandemic, because I don't think any of us wanted to hear any more sad stories about that.
No, you know, I can't tell you how many scripts I've gotten about the pandemic, and I just don't even want to look at them because it's like, been there, done that. I think we're still too close to it to get any objectivity about it, you know?
I said to him, I said, you know, I don't know if I can be involved in this if it's going to be a bunch of downer stories. And he said, you know, no.
No, I mean, it turned out to be kind of fun. And I know the filmmakers, you know, especially the indie filmmakers who are used to doing these kind of things, you know, picking up a camera and just shooting, but it sort of got their creative juices going at a time when a lot of creativity was going out the window. But so tell me, I mean, do you work in film as well, or do you do underscoring as well for television programming? You know, what kind of, especially during the pandemic, what kind of things were you working on while we were all locked down?
I do actually. And in end of 2019, I hooked up with a director named Josh Friedlander, and we did a film for Sony called Holly Slept Over. It was with Natalie Emanuel, Ron Livingston, and Josh Lawson. It was kind of a romantic comedy, you know, indie film. And then I did a couple of TV movies for the Lifetime channel and the Hallmark channel. And I would love to do more films. I've done a bunch of short films, but I've been so kind of pigeonholed into this TV world that it's been a little hard to kind of move over. And especially as kind of a theme writer. I mean, I wrote a theme for a new show on Access TV just recently.
Yeah.
I wrote a theme for an animated, a very popular animated series on Amazon recently. And you know, it just seems to be where the work is. But yeah, I mean, I would like to do more films than I've done, but I did do two films last year, and I'm actually, like I said, getting ready to do a new film now, a new horror film. So I'm looking forward to that very much.
I love how humble Jason is. You know, he's like, oh, I did this thing on Amazon. It's only one of the top 10 animated series on Amazon, Jersey and Nessie. And I mean,
it's very
just
popular.
I had to just point
very
that
popular.
Out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah. Where does the diversity come from, Jason? You have so many different styles. I mean, flipping between doing themes for news shows, essentially, to, you know, to variety, to underscoring animation. Did you always think you were going to be that diverse in your output, or did it just happen naturally?
Well, you know, I don't think I thought I was going to be that diverse. I know that early on my musical influences were very diverse. So, you know, I had a lot of different music coming from a lot of different genres. When I got into music for television, I submitted some music for something, and a really wonderful music supervisor asked me to come in and meet with him. And so I did. And he sat me down, and one of the things he said, he goes, I love what you're doing here. It's really great. But if you want to if you want to make it in this business, kid, you're going to have to be really diversify and learn how to do all sorts of different styles. And this was, you know, in about
that was good advice, right?
I mean, amazing. Because, you know, I was mostly a guitar player. I'd always played piano, but I was mostly a guitar player. And I sort of thought, and I thought in terms of songs and bands, and I was coming from kind of a live thing where I was used to playing live. And so I sort of went down that road and thought, okay, well, that sounds actually like kind of a fun challenge to get into all these different genres and see if I can do it. And it turns out that I was able to do it. And, you know, I really spent, you know, I've spent the last 20 years just studying and learning.
When did you start playing? How old were you when you started?
I started playing guitar when I was probably 9 or 10, and then got, you know, more serious about it when I was a teenager, 15, 16.
Yeah.
And I had actually, you know, I had studied classical guitar when I was about 14 or 15. I started studying because I wanted to go to a classical conservatory in England, because I'd been to England and I loved the country and I loved the people and the culture. And I just thought it was so great. And of course, I'd loved so much of the music that had come out of there.
Right.
Beatles, Stones, Pink Floyd, you know, Zeppelin.
Everything,
Sabbath, etc. But I wanted to study classical music.
Right.
And classical composition. So I worked towards that. I ended up going over to England when I was 17 and trying out for two conservatories, but was rejected by both of them because I had been a bad boy in high school and I had disciplinary
marks. No way.
Exactly. It was terrible. Pretty heartbreaking. Yeah.
And you didn't want to come to Juilliard in New York?
Well, you know, it's funny. I did consider Juilliard, and I'm trying to remember who it was that dissuaded me. I think it was my dad. Although if I'm wrong about that, I apologize, Pop. and he encouraged me to go to Berkeley, which is where I ended up going.
So you wound up in a really good place.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. But I think that the pigeonholing, you know, the one thing that becomes more and more obvious by the day is that art and commerce are not mutually exclusive. So whatever way you come into the creative flow, it's all valid and it all works, you know, and clearly doing the kind of things that you've done and making them work shows that you could do anything if you want to. So, you know, there's no difference in doing what you did to start out and then scoring a movie. So.
Well, you know, I appreciate you saying that, Rose. I agree with you.
I'll tell everybody about you.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Music, as Jason knows, for me is a very important component of everything I do in film. And because I do a lot of period stuff, sometimes we like to kind of mix and match, you know, even though, you know, if we're doing something in the 40s or the 50s, you know, we may take classical jazz and then mix it with something that's contemporary, and it just somehow works if you do it the right way. But it's really, really important to get the right scoring for a film. It is the difference between, as Jason says, between a good movie and a great one.
Yeah.
We have to introduce Jason to your friend Claire Van Kampen.
Yes.
Who was just on the show. Because of these roots that Jason has, you know, he's not even talking about like learning clarinet in elementary school. We talked about that earlier in the show. But he's doing these concertos and these pieces now that we have to connect him with Claire for. Tell us a little bit about the concertos that you're doing.
Tell me about that.
Well, so in 2015, I got this idea sort of popped into my head. I would like to think it was divinely inspired. And it said, start writing for the orchestra. You can do it. And I thought to myself, well, I have loved the orchestra and I've loved classical music my whole life. So, you know, and I'd been doing a lot of stuff with orchestral instruments and with small sections and stuff for different pieces of underscore and different things in television and film already. So I set out, I kind of looked it up. And one of the suggestions from a colleague was start writing for the sections before you try to write for the whole orchestra. So I thought, I'll write for strings first.
Yeah.
And so I started with quartets. And in 2015, I wrote these five quartets. They're 4 or 5 minutes long. And I worked with an orchestrator and we went in, we recorded a live section playing them. And it was really inspiring to me because they came out, I really liked them. I was very satisfied with how they came out. And it's funny, I don't know if Donovan's listening, but a couple of years later, Donovan and I did a show together called Sanctum, and they ended up using these quartets in that show. But when I did them, I had no design on them doing anything other than just being there for people to hear. But that kind of opened the door, and at that point, I started really sort of boring down into orchestrations and writing in that style and in that genre. And every year, it's opened up more and more to me. And, you know, I've been hired to do some stuff. I've done a ton of stuff on my own. And now I've written a few things that are on YouTube that are just kind of there as we call it absolute music. It's really just music for the sake of music, for really for right. nothing else. And right. I'm quite happy doing that, I have to say. And now I'm about 2 weeks out of finishing a 30-minute concerto for orchestra.
Wow.
And I've been talking to a couple of different conductors and other classical composers about getting it performed live. Now, I always want to make the distinction that I'm not trying to write classical music. I'm writing modern orchestral music.
Right, modern orchestral.
I think we actually have a sample of some of that music. Milfredo.
That is wonderful.
So brilliant.
Oh, God. It was one point I felt like I was watching Dr. Zhivago. It's so wonderful.
Yes.
So, Jason, you definitely, yeah. So, have you ever thought of doing legitimate theater or musicals or anything like that as well?
You know, it's funny you should ask that, Rose. Like so much of my musical life, things kind of seem to unfold naturally in a way when I start pursuing certain things. And just recently I got asked to produce with a partner of mine, Amit Zappa, a musical feature. And
wow.
You know, I wasn't super confident in doing so at first because I hadn't done anything like that yet. And we got in there and produced the first three songs, and it was amazing. It's not traditional musical theater. It's actually musical theater with kind of an 80s twist to it, which right. is super fun.
Yeah, which is what the market wants right now.
It does.
I don't know if you got to see Moulin Rouge, but I was telling Jason the other day when I went to the premiere of that, it was like watching a three-ring circus of like the best 73 songs that have ever been recorded. I mean, the music rights for that musical must have cost
insane.
An absolute fortune.
I saw the film years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and the stage production is just, it's incredible. But you see, like, David Byrne is on Broadway, and, like, you've got all of these things that have to do with popular music, and that's what people want to see and what they want to go to, you know? So I think the time for what you're doing is absolutely right. I go to theater a lot, so I can tell you it's a good time.
Well, it's very interesting because the partner that I worked with on Little Ellen, his name's Jason Blackman, another Jason.
Yes.
And we were talking about writing a musical together, and with my wife also, who used to sing on Broadway and comes from the musical theater background.
Well, there you go.
Wonderful vocalist, and she and I have done so many things together. She's been a wonderful part of my musical journey through TV and everything. So the three of us were talking about writing a musical, and then we met these agents in New York at ICM that wanted to rep us to write a musical. I mean, we mentioned your musical, Donovan, once again. I don't know if he's listening, but Head Over Heels came up, and they liked that very much too, and they knew all about you and doing all of that. So
yeah. So you three guys, I mean, Amit Donovan and you, I mean, clearly you came from musical families.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily translate to a next generation. You know, sometimes a parent could do one thing and the kid goes to Wall Street or something.
Absolutely.
Or becomes a lawyer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So did you feel you were predestined to do this, or did you, it's something you really were surrounded by and then really wanted to do?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Rose, and I have been pondering that my whole life. And the reason is that part of me wonders if nurture was a huge influence, and so much so that it kind of colored the way I thought about what I was going to be and who I was going to be versus nature. Was it in my blood? Was it a natural thing for me to do? And so I've had these conversations with people. Was I supposed to do this, or did I feel that I was supposed to do this because I was in a musical family and musical environments? And I never really get a definitive answer, but it always leans more towards this is just naturally what I am drawn to just as an individual, separate from nurture and separate from my environment and separate from my parents. However, having musical parents and having musical friends like Donovan and Amit, and the list goes on, has been a wonderful way to actually implement what is my right purpose. So right. It's an amazing combination of all of that, and a question that you know, one of those introspective questions that I ask from time to time. But it's definitely growing up in West Hollywood, in Los Angeles, in the 70s,
yeah.
was an amazing time.
I bet.
If music and art and that kind of
was
thing.
Was everywhere.
It was everywhere. And it would just, you know, we were...
I don't know if you noticed, but there is a rush of documentaries about the whole Laurel Canyon musical scene and everything that was going on the West Coast in the 70s in terms of music. It's quite interesting to look back and view all of that with the prism of time. But truly, I don't feel it's been equaled or surpassed.
It was an amazing time, and Donovan and I were right in the middle of it, for sure. And
yeah.
my mother actually documented a lot of it with photography, and she has been in a couple of the recent documentaries as a talking head and showing her pictures and talking about her experiences. So, I mean,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, we were right there, right in Laurel Canyon and all their houses.
That's something very special.
It was. It absolutely was, yeah.
Jason, it's been a distinct pleasure for me to meet with you, and I hope we can talk about film in the near future, and I'm going to pass this on to the other Jason.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you so much, guys.
My pleasure. Pleasure to meet you and talk with
you,
Rose.
Nice to meet you, too.
Yeah.
This has been so much fun. Thank you both, and yeah, I don't want this to end, actually, but of course, time, there's no
All good
time.
Things must come to an end.
They do. We leave our audience wanting more, I guess.
All right.
Well, this has been great.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Hi, Edge. How are things?
Doing good, Jason. Thanks. So you ready to start editing?
Always ready, thanks to New Monkey Studio, the ultimate recording facility.
Yep.
It's the first virtual studio I've ever worked with.
Well, we're not just virtual.
Of course you are. I'm in Ireland. You're in LA. We're recording.
Yes, this is true. But we are a full-service recording studio with some legendary gear.
Legendary? Wow, Edge. I think that's the most you've said to me since we started working together. What's this gear you're referring to?
Well, our mixing board was used by David Bowie, Rush, The Police. You know.
No way. I managed Andy Summers for a while.
Yep, he's in the Police.
Can anyone record at New Monkey?
Anyone? Sure. So are you ready to edit?
Yeah, let's do that after, but tell us how we can find New Monkey Studio.
You can find us on Instagram at New Monkey Studio, and we have a website, newmonkeystudio.com.
You too can be cool like Edge and record with legendary gear in LA or from anywhere in the world at New Monkey Studio. That's newmonkeystudio.com. Ask for Edge.
Sync opportunities, sync opportunities.
let me put a spotlight on the Sync Report players, the people that make this show happen every week. Lisa Dunn, our lead researcher, our writer, one of my dear friends. Now she's like dabbling in merchandise even because we've been dealing with coffee mugs and socks. How are you, lady?
I'm good. I had to actually look up why there's a balloon on my face today, and it's because I guess it's my 1 year anniversary with Clubhouse.
I was wondering. I thought somehow you figured out some cool techie thing that we don't have, and you know, now you're just showing off. I want a balloon. I want to say a quick hello to Jody Lynn. Hello, Jodester. How you doing, lady?
Hello. Happy spring. Today's the first day of spring. Thank God. How's everybody really doing today? Yes.
Thank God.
Finally. Yeah.
Well, the flowers are in bloom in Ireland.
We have some blooming here, but boy, it was a long winter.
Yeah, Jody does all the amazing graphics for the shows. She does our podcast covers. She's created decks for us, business cards, playing cards. The woman's a machine. Hello, Paula Flack. This was your mental idea. You're taking responsibility.
Hello. Sorry, I was just tweeting the room.
Good, doing your job. I like that. That's acceptable.
I know. Welcome to all our Irish friends. How are you?
Yeah, I'm hanging in there. I've been looking forward to tonight's show. Weirdly, you know, I don't really get this excited. So now let me introduce you to our music department. Dawn. Hello, Dawn. How you doing?
Hello, Jason. Hello from sunny Los Angeles, 73 degrees. It's a beautiful day.
So you're not at Disneyland today?
I am not.
Okay. All right. Just checking to make sure. Because you'll be in Disneyland like 90 times a week. Why don't we move into the listening section? Let me just say a quick hello to Flynn. Flynn, I got to tell you, Killian played B-side on his show on Red FM. I don't know. It was probably pre-pandemic, so it's been a while. But it hit me like a ton of bricks. I absolutely think you're genius. So pleased that you're joining us on the show today. I can't wait to play everybody some of the new music you're working on. But please say a quick hello. Give us a bit of an introduction and tell us what you're working on.
Hello. Nice to meet everybody. Thanks very much, Jason. And thanks, Killian, obviously, for spreading the word. Yeah, so I'm Flynn. I'm a singer-songwriter artist from Mullingar, which is a small town in Ireland. Midlands of Ireland. I'm working on various projects at the moment for other people, and then I'm about to launch my own EP, my second EP. I'm busy over here. I'm living in London at the moment, so enjoying.
Oh, you
London.
Are in London.
I am. Yeah, I'm in London. Yeah.
Why don't we like go back and forth? Let's. Dawn, Heather, can we play B-side just so the audience gets an idea of the caliber of talent on the stage?
She's always got a lover on the B-side, so she won't mind if I walk away. She's got another someone on the east side. She don't hold me like she used to. Tell me, what's the story? I can see that something's going down. This will bore me, so let's draw the line and do some talking. I'm the one that likes to beat around. Yeah. When it comes to me and you, yeah, I think I always knew, and now it's time to face the truth. She's always got a lover on the B-side, so she won't mind if I walk away. She's got another someone on the east side. She don't need me anyway, and I won't call.
Okay, so tell me, how great is that track? And you know what? It's funny, Finn, because when Killian played that track, I just kind of assumed it was American. I thought you were like a kid from New York talking about, you know, East Side, West Side. And Killian's like, we do have an East Side and West Side in Ireland as well. So, yeah, I was blown away to find out you're Irish. I'm so excited to have you on the stage. I'd love to know a little bit of background on that track. Is there actually, was that written for a girl you know?
Possibly.
It smelled like it all over. So, oh, God, well, you got to tell us the story. Tell us about yourself. When did you move to London? There's so much I want to know.
Yeah, so I moved to London. I've kind of been over and back, God, for the last 6-7 years, I think. My dad lives over here, so I've always come over to visit him.
And oh, great.
Yeah, I've always been over here kind of trying to make it happen. I actually moved to Bristol. That was my first stop after finishing my Leaving Cert, which is, you know, your final exams in Ireland, if you like, before college or university.
Yeah.
So I went to Bristol, and with really just no plans, I just kind of just packed a bag, bought a guitar and left. I kind of wanted to just kind of hook up with as many people, link up with as many musicians as possible. Bristol seemed like a nice start because it's, you know, relatively smaller in comparison to big bad London, you know. So I just went there. I did a year in kind of college. I did like an access course, which introduced me to some amazing creatives, musicians, producers. And from there, I kind of like journeyed my way through going over and back to Ireland every now and again if something came up there, or if a gig opportunity came up. And you know, I'd do the same in London. I'd be just kind of chasing every open mic night I could, trying to get heard, really. I guess there was some heat at the time, and one thing kind of led to the next. And I worked with an amazing independent record label in Ireland called The Fusion Lab, and they launched my first project, if you like, my first few singles. And yeah, from there, it kind of, you know, my first song blew up, if you like. When I say blew up, I mean at the time a million streams, you know, was a big number for me or for any artist releasing their first single. Yeah, after that, I mean, it's crazy. I ended up writing some songs with Lost Frequencies, and you know, we went platinum in some countries, and I signed to Sony, and it's all kind of happened.
So is that all
fast.
Is that before B-side, or was that off the back of B-side?
That was before B-side. I was always a great friend of mine, Mark Valance, who I work with a lot, kind of put me in touch with some amazing writers over here in London, and I started exploring that whole scene, I suppose, you know, over here, of just kind of going into a room and writing with some of the best writers that London has to offer. And yeah, I just, you know, I got very lucky with this particular song that was pitched to Felix from Lost Frequencies. And from there, the song went on to do quite well. And, you know, we went platinum in Belgium, and I got to perform on at Tomorrowland, and I got to perform on, do TV appearances and all the things that as an artist you kind of dream about doing. And then since then, obviously, well, then I released my own project. So I released my first single with Sony, which was called One of Us. And I mean, we literally launched this just before the pandemic kicked off. So, you know, you can imagine it wasn't very linear. It wasn't easier to promote the music or to gig and to spread
what you
it.
Yeah, the touring is so important around promotion. So that's just, you know, a handicap nobody wants during a release.
No, absolutely. It's even just radio interviews, you know, you want to meet people face to face and really build that rapport and just make friends as you do it, you know. So it was just for me, I mean, it was a bit of a difficult time for everyone, but I guess I was ready to really get started. And then we were all just kind of left in limbo, and not even my label, you know, knew what to do. And that was the scary thing about the pandemic, was nobody actually knew what to do. You know, there was nobody to go to and look for advice, really, because it was, you know, we'd never seen it like it before.
Never happened before.
So, yeah, so now we're coming out on the back end, and things seem to be, COVID-wise anyway, I know there's a lot of other big problems going on in the world right now, but COVID seems to be on the decline, so that's good. So we're planning loads of new music. I've got, you know, singles lined up, and then I'm going to release my
second EP. Yeah, you're another one that has an arsenal of music ready to come out. In fact, why don't we pivot into that, Flynn? Let's dive in. Let's get the music going. Let's get the juices flowing in the audience. Let's remind them what you are as a songwriter. Dawn, what's the song we have from Flynn?
Yes, the song that we have from Flynn is One of Us.
Born to rise and yeah, form and fly. You never want it to end. Stepping stones far away from home. I had a future to mend. I've been lost and I've been dying to find a piece of me again. Now I'm back here and it's beating inside. I feel it all again. Back on my home ground, beating it all out. I know what it is now to be one of us, one of us. Back on my home ground, beating it all out. I know what it is now to be one of us, one of us.
God, Flynn, that is gorgeous. Tell us a little bit about that track.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah, so that song's basically about my move away from Ireland. When I was 19, as I said, I moved away from home. I guess, you know, in the midst of trying to make it as a musician, I guess I lost a run of myself a little bit, and I noticed changes mentally that I suppose affected me for a long time after that. I had my own struggles with anxiety, just afraid to be a failure like every other artist, that self-doubt, that crippling self-doubt. And I guess not being around...
Imposter syndrome.
Exactly that. And I guess just not being at home and not being just around my friends and around my family for so long had a larger effect on me than I thought it did. But for me, it was almost like an escape. At the time, I felt like I needed to run away to find myself and to really become the artist and the person who I wanted to be. But in hindsight, I wish I hadn't done that. I think I kind of left too much behind. So really what One of Us is about is just that realization when you do actually kind of come back to yourself and you feel whole again and you feel like yourself again. But for me, it was just really kind of regrouping with family and friends and actually moving home, because it got to the point where things got very bad for me, where I guess very dark, where I just felt I needed to be around friends and family. And the strangest thing about it was that within a week or 2 weeks, I mean, I felt a lot better. And it was just, as I said, that realization that kind of how important home is and how important just family and friends are in general, I suppose. And just that togetherness and just that feeling of like of belonging, you know, is just so important as human beings. And I just think that sometimes we can neglect it.
And this is what I'm loving about this show tonight. I mean, sometimes I think we don't know, we forget the price the songwriter pays to create art. The pain, you know, you could feel the pain, the anguish, the emotion that, you know, as humans, we all suffer through. And, you know, they say music is universal. It's because of songwriters like you, you know, you're communicating something that we all have in common. Oh, my God. Yeah, Flynn, thank you for sharing that and that beautiful song. Christine, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that track.
Oh, my God. Flynn, I love what you just said, because exactly what I wrote down, I'm going to read to you. Unpacking boxes, airplane looking out window, seeing yourself on a billboard with entourage, getting your luggage, feeling disconnected.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there, Christine, I think.
And I don't even know you, but that's what I got.
Yeah, no, that's not fair. That's not fair off at all, to be honest with you.
I feel like I do know you now, because it's like it was laser sharp to me.
Amazing.
This is the beauty of it, when you know, when you're strong and brave enough to be honest. You know, what these artists are doing are being honest. They're letting you see their pain. You know, and we're so trained, you know, you got to be strong and don't be weak. But yet these amazing artists are doing just the opposite. Vinks, am I crazy, or can you believe what's going on in this room tonight?
Taking it in, man. I'm loving it. Loving the room. You know, we always do. It's just great. You know, I just love it. You know,
good energy tonight.
Beautiful energy. And it's just perfect to show that these gourmet chefs of film go out and choose the right spice and flavor to accompany their visual presence in the scene. So it's great. I love it. The growth of everybody. It's just beautiful.
Oh, thank you, Vinks. Yeah, absolutely incredible. Flynn, we have one more track of yours to play. We're going to play from our community quickly, and then we're going to play one more from Flynn. Dawn, let's bring up our artist from the Sync Report.
Let's listen to Midas, Home is Hollowed Ground.
I was lost on an unexpected ocean, shipwrecked in a year that was broken. Still something was leading me, and it brought me here. It brought me here. I'm forever changed by all I've lost and all I've craved. And I'm forever grateful for all I've gained. When everything changes, there's one thing
cliff's edge. In the crashing of the waves, I almost missed it. But something was leading me, and it brought me here. It brought me here. I'm forever changed by all I've lost and all I've bring. And I'm forever grateful for all I've gained. When everything changes, there's one thing that remains. This hallowed ground. Home is hallowed ground.
God, I honestly, Midas, how do you keep surprising me? Like, at some point, I'm just going to be like, oh, whatever it is, it's going to be great. But, you know, first I hear this female voice come in. The song is like, I don't know. I don't think somebody's written the perfect sync song. You know, I'm just trying to think. Randy Newman is on the machine, or Brian Adams. I mean, this song is like the dream sync song. Midas, what is this? This is so different from the stuff you played us before.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Jason. I really appreciate that. As usual, you guys are like just so supportive of me and this community. So I'm really happy to be here. And thanks again for playing this song. This is an incredible song that I wrote with an amazing songwriter, Kyler England, who has done very well for herself in the sync space. And she's a superstar. She and I collaborated on this. This is actually the third song I'd ever written in a collaboration when I first started this journey. So the backstory goes, she was in a class. I saw her speak and I reached out to her and said, I've got to work with you. You're an amazing human being. She responded really receptively to what I was saying. And we got together. We sat down for 4 hours. And the first 2 hours were just about talking about what's happening in the world. So for me, this song was extremely cathartic during a very dark time in our world. I wrote this song in December of 2020, and I really just started writing music at that point and getting started in the music business. So this song, though, I said to her, I said, how would you feel about singing on this song? And she's like an incredible artist in her own right. So she's like, I'd love to sing on this song with you. So I was like blown away. And the first three chords she threw down on the piano, I just said, stop. We don't need to go any further. So the root chords to this song were created, and then the rest just became a production piece with my producer, Jonathan Wyman. We took it all the way, and I said to her, I said, look, I think there's a good possibility we could probably get some visibility on this. And sure as shoot, like a day later, we got an opportunity to get a rep deal on the song. So it happened very quickly. I don't usually go into it this far, so meaning, you know, tell you the backstory, but it was really, she's an incredible artist.
I'm glad you did.
I had a chance to work with her on three other songs, and I really enjoy working with her. So it is very different. It's very bipolar for me, where I work as a singer-songwriter on a lot of my songs, but as you know, I love the rock and roll stuff too. That just fits me as well. So I've got this sort of like...
That's the thing. There's such a... like a purest white light around that song, which it's lovely that you can tap that side as well and do it so eloquently. Christine, what, talk to me. Did that kind of bring you back, you know, in filmmaking history almost? It was like,
well, so I think you can make new filmmaking history. Here's what I'm thinking. Like, when I hear a song like this, this is something that's kind of like a theme song or can brand a film. And you know how composers will use a song or a melody like this one and put it throughout a film. And what you do is you associate this song with a specific character in the film. So you understand what the character is feeling every time you hear part of the melody of the song. And that's what makes something like this powerful, because it brings back an emotion and it trains the audience to feel an emotion.
So perfectly said. Midas, unbelievable. I'm just so glad you're part of this community. Thank you for continuing to send more music that just, you know, every time you just step it up. It's just amazing.
Thank you so much, Jason. And thank you so much for the feedback. I really appreciate it. By the way, I just wanted to go out of my way tonight to say this has been an amazing show. Flynn's music really, it resonates with me, you know, like the vibe, the feel. And it certainly is cathartic the way that music can help the soul, you know, and that's what I feel.
Isn't it?
How impressive this crew is, like the talent in the room. Always, I'm blown away, Jason. So thank you so much for everything.
Oh, man. Thank you, Midas. I love that you just, you know, added that. This is the thing, is having respect, and, you know, this is not a competition, you know, we're making art. You're making the art. So, you know, if we can all appreciate each other, that's just beautiful. Thank you, Midas.
Yeah, that was amazing, man. Thanks for the kind words as well, man. I really appreciate it. And yeah, I agree. It's been really nice to listen to some music as well, and just kind of step out of the, I don't know, it's nice for people to listen to music as a musician again, and just kind of really dive into what you guys are trying to talk about and what you're saying. And it's just, yeah, great space, but great song, man. Really, really good.
I'm dying over here. I want to hear some Flynn. Can I hear some Flynn, ladies?
All right, so here we go with Flynn's Selling Me Love.
My heart was open, ready for the ride of my life. And I was buying something that could never be mine. Come around with just me, nothing. Such is good, and so I keep on coming back. Made me feel like I was something that you wanted, and now you got it.
That is what a song. Flynn, you're a genius. I know that you have more stuff coming out, and I would love to have you back on and play it when you're ready. But yeah, thank you for being such a gentleman, such an amazing talent, and such a lovely contributor to the show tonight.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, man. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much to our amazingly talented guests for joining us on today's show, and to you, our listeners, for spending your time listening to us and being with us. The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, myself, Colin O'Donoghue, Rose Ganguza, and Jason P. Rothberg. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.